Still short. Let's pray. God, I pray that this morning that the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart would be pleasing to you. And Lord, I pray that all of us gathered here today would have ears to hear what it is you want to say. Amen. So when I agreed to preach this week, and Aaron mentioned that the theme for Lent was rivers in the desert, there was a very small part of me that wanted to laugh. Because in many ways, thinking about rivers in the desert feels like coming home. I grew up in a small town in the middle of Washington that fits absolutely none of the stereotypes you've ever heard about the state. Located on the eastern side of the Cascades and technically caught in the mountain's rain shadow, my hometown of Wenatchee has a climate categorized just below a desert as a semi-arid shrub steppe, a fact I learned in my fifth grade ecology unit and I have somehow never forgotten. Thank you, Lincoln Elementary School. The town gets less than 9 inches of rain a year. Comparatively, Chicago gets about 39. And the average temperature in the months of July and August is about 90 degrees each day, though I always remember there being at least a few weeks where it was consistently above 100, always. And in my millennial version of having to walk to school uphill both ways, I frequently liked to remind my friends that in the 1930s home I grew up in, there was no air conditioning. And while the hills that surrounded our valley were almost always brown, the green growth of spring only lasted about a week before the grasses died in the heat. The Wenatchee Valley always felt and is full of life and agriculture, in large part because the Columbia River runs directly through the center of town. Irrigation from the river feeds so many fruit trees that Wenatchee markets itself as the apple capital of the world. In fact, I buy Honeycrisps here in Chicago that were grown mere miles from my mom's house. There is life among the people, too, a thriving community that appreciates art and nature, that spends days working hard on the land and playing hard on the river. And so when I think about rivers in the desert, I think about this paradox of abundant life in what could otherwise be a barren place. I think about the desert and I think about the river, and I think about how it is at that place where those two points meet that I have somehow always found myself at home. And perhaps that's true here, too. This Sunday marks 2 years of pandemic precautions and isolations, and it has certainly been a 2 years that have felt like the desert. We've been armed with different tools for survival, trading water bottles for masks and sunscreen for hand sanitizer. We have wandered long and far, though we have rarely left the house, and we have grown tired and weary. And now, as we are starting to see things open back up and masks come off, for some people, it feels like the sweet relief of diving into the river on a hot July day. For others, particularly our immunocompromised friends and parents of small children, these changes may come with new fears and trepidations. It feels like in some ways we are standing on that riverbank while others are reminding us, and we're still in the desert. To stand on that bank is to hold the tension of knowing that more than one thing can be true at the same time. The water in the river does not negate the fact that the land is desperate for rain. The heat in the desert will not dry up the Columbia. This Lent, I have found myself thinking about how often that is true for myself emotionally as well, that I'm at home in a place of paradox, places where sorrow and joy, where despair and hope, struggle and comfort, longing and abundance seem to coexist even when I don't want them to. There's tension in those spaces, and I think we see it today in the Old Testament text. Our text is about a man named Abram, who later gets known as Abraham. And to understand what is happening to him here in chapter 15, we have to go back to the beginning of his story. We're first introduced to Abram and his wife Sarai, later named Sarah, in chapter 11 of Genesis, when the couple is childless and living in the Mesopotamian city of Haran. In chapter 12, when Abram is 75 years old, the Lord calls him to leave his country and go to a new land, Canaan. And as God gives this command, God offers Abram this promise: I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. I will bless you, God says, so that you yourself might be a blessing. And so Abram, his wife Sarai, their nephew Lot, and their household leave their home in Haran and head toward Canaan. Once there, the Lord again appears to Abram and promises, "To your offspring I will leave this land." Now, if I were Abram here, I would probably be pretty skeptically hopeful. I'd be looking around at the land thinking, like, you know what, man, this looks pretty good. I might be confused about how I'd have kids in my old age, but I would probably be so desperate for that hope that I would be clinging to belief. But here's the thing. Time goes by and nothing happens. At least there is no child. In the meantime, Abram and his family travel all over the land, from Canaan to Egypt, Egypt to the Negev, to Bethel, to Ai, and back to Canaan. In the process, we learn in Genesis 13 that Abram becomes exceedingly wealthy, gathering large amounts of livestock, silver, and gold. There's some grand rescue that happens when Abram's cousin Lot gets caught up in trouble. You can read that story some other time. And all of that leads us to our text today. In the beginning of chapter 15, God appears to Abram in a vision. "Do not be afraid, Abram," God proclaims. Words that ironically generally herald good news in the Bible. That's not how I introduce it, but God can do what God wants to do. Like in Genesis 12, God offers Abram a promise. "I am your shield. Your reward shall be very great." But almost immediately here, the pattern deviates. In Genesis 12, when God blesses Abram and tells him to go, there's no discussion. The text simply records God's command and blessing, and the very next sentence is, "So Abram went," immediately obedient. In today's text, though, Abram does not passively accept these words and just go. He talks back. "O Lord God, what will you give me? For I continue childless, and the heir of my house is Eleazar of Damascus. You have given me no offspring, and so a slave born in my house is to be my heir." There are a lot of ways you could read Abram's tone here. Some scholars think he's merely curious, asking God a question. Others point out the inherent racism of Abram's dismay at the idea of a slave inheriting. As I read it, Abram is angry with God. He is skeptical. This is a man who gave up his home at 75 years of age to follow God on a journey through the literal desert. And while there aren't exact timelines listed in this section of the text, because of the dates that surrounding events have, many scholars think about 10 years have passed between the first promise in Genesis 12 and the covenant we see here in chapter 15. Abram was promised that he would be the father of a great nation, and yet here he is 10 years later, 85 and childless. His words here to God, "You have given me no offspring, and so a slave born in my house is to be my heir," are nothing short of lament. The Rezkov Book Club met this week to talk about Sue Monk Kidd's novel, The Book of Longings, in which she imagines what it might have looked like if Jesus had a wife. And as I got ready for our meeting, I was reading interviews with Sue Monk Kidd and came across a section where she was talking about the book's title. And she said, "Whenever I begin to work on a new novel, I want to know two things, who my character is and what she longs for." It has been an interesting question to mull over the past few days. Who is Abram? What does he long for? God promises Abram a reward, and his response is basically, "So what? What do I want from you?" We know he's wealthy. Genesis 13 has already told us that. And so Abram doesn't need more things. The deepest longing of his heart is for this child. It is a longing and pain that far too many even today know all too well. In Abram's time, it was an ache that was accompanied by the fact that children were a form of insurance, a guarantee that you would be taken care of throughout your life, and a promise that your name would live on. It would be hard to envision a kind future without children. Abram longs for a child, and as I asked Sue Monk Kidd's question of Abram this week, I also asked it of myself. Who am I, and what do I long for? We all have our answers to that question. For some, like Abram, it's the longing for children and a legacy. For others, it's a longing for our children to thrive. Maybe it's the longing for a partner or community, for stability and growth in a job, for a safe place to call home, for relief for your physical and mental health, for the betterment of society. There are days where it is hard to look to the future with hope, and where God's promises seem like they will stay promises only. Abram hears the promise of the Lord, and as professor of Old Testament Rolf Jacobson puts it, rather than praising God for this new promise, Abram cried out in pain regarding the deepest hurt and unfulfilled hope in his life. He and Sarai were still childless. Most weeks, I identify much more with this Genesis 15 version of Abram than I do with the immediately obedient servant in chapter 12 who hears the promise and packs his bags. Try as I might, I'm not like that. I am much more likely to find myself meeting even good news with caution and skepticism. There are days in this where I feel like Abram in this passage, where the things that I am longing for seem far too big, where I don't trust that God will keep promises. There are days where I'm not convinced that white supremacy will ever be thwarted, that war would ever cease, that climate change might be reversed. There are developments in my own personal life that I've been longing for so long, and it seems like no progress has been made. And so I deeply appreciate the lesson of Abram's lament. Abram models for us this image of being honest before the Lord, of telling God exactly what we desire, of exactly what was promised, and reminding God of how they have yet to live up to their end of the bargain. As Rolf Jacobson writes, to tell God about our deepest hurts and unmet hopes is to implicate God in those hurts and hopes. It is rhetorically to align God's desires with ours and to make our problems God's problems. Jacobson continues, when we complain, we cry out to God in the belief that God can and perhaps even will respond to our cries, our wants, our needs, our desires. God has the power and ability to respond. To complain, Jacobson writes, is to complain to God is to have faith that God is faithful, both to the creation and to the divine promises, in spite of present circumstances in which it certainly appears and feels from our perspective that God is not being effectively and faithfully present. Maybe for some of us today, we are in the heart of the desert. And the only relief our parched throats will accept is that of lament, of crying out honestly to God about our deepest hurts and unmet hopes. And the good news today is that God hears. Abram is honest with God about the deepest longings of his heart. He wants a child. And God's response is not to simply reiterate the original promise, but expand it. God tells Abram that he will indeed have a child, then states, look toward heaven and count the stars. If you are able to count them, so shall your descendants be. In doing so, he offers Abram this tangible reference to the promise. On the nights when Abram doubted, he need only look up and remember. I was thinking about the context of this promise this week. And about Jacobson's words that voicing our complaint to God is an expression that we trust God will be faithful even when it doesn't look like God will. And the context, I think, matters because if God had made that promise to me here in Chicago, it wouldn't seem like much. I can easily count the stars here because the city is so bright I can't see any, except for maybe one satellite that I've convinced myself is a star. But I used to spend my summers working in rural Maine, at a camp located in the middle of 5,000 acres of trees, half an hour from the closest town of 800 people, where there was not a whisper of light pollution. And the sky was like nothing I've ever seen. I spent many a night laying out under the stars, the crisp, clear air giving me a view of the Milky Way. It was abundance like I have never seen. And here's the thing that I know. Those same stars are still present in Illinois, even when I can't see them. It's not that they've gone away, they're just hidden by the muck of life. And just like I know that the stars are still there, I want to believe this too, that God is faithful even in the desert, even when I cannot see. God is faithful even when there seems to be no answers, no solutions, when the promises that have been made are still years and decades away from being fulfilled. The text says that Abram heard this promise and he believed. That belief feels so brave to me, to trust even in the face of years of unanswered prayers and promises that God will indeed be faithful. The text says that this belief is reckoned to Abram as righteousness, a word that often means the meeting of obligations and expectations in a relationship. God has made this promise on his end, and Abram's side is that he's asked to believe. And that, too, is what we are asked to do. I am not saying it's easy. There are unfortunately all too many people who have been hurt and abused by the church and by people claiming to act on behalf of God. There are many of us weary of our relationship with God, embittered by years that have passed without answered promises. It can understandably be hard to believe in those circumstances. I've been there myself. And I trust that even here, God holds our laments and God honors our belief and trust as tentative as it may be. I trust that the river of belief, even if it is just the trickle of a stream, can meander its way through the harshest desert. God promises Abram children and land, and then Abram again responds with this question that I think is oh so relatable. How am I to know? How do I really know, God, that you're going to follow through this time? Abram's asking for some certainty here, something I think we all long for in life and faith. In my own experience, this is something I want so badly that in February 2020, I decided that for Lent, I was going to let go of certainty. I am not saying that my spiritual practice caused the pandemic, but I am saying that I have chosen more carefully every Lent since. But rather than teaching Abram the lesson of sitting in uncertainty, God responds. He has Abram go and gather these sacrificial animals and cleave them in two. Abram does this as the sun sets and he falls into a deep sleep. A vision of God comes to him again, and Abram sees a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch go between these pieces. Historically speaking, this ritual was referred to as the cutting of a covenant. Animals would be cut in half, and the person who was making the covenant commitment would walk in between them. Symbolically, this meant that the person who walked between the animals was committing that if they broke that covenant and did not fulfill that promise, they would submit to be cut in half, just like the sacrificed animal. And all I'm saying is that my business law class in college could have been a lot more entertaining. We cannot downplay the significance of this. That the creator of the universe, represented in Abram's vision as a smoking fire pot and flaming torch, was so committed to his promise to Abram, he was willing to die. And indeed, this commitment to humanity, even unto death, is what Christians look toward as we prepare for Christ's death and resurrection during Lent. Ultimately, God does keep the promise to Abram. Renamed Abraham, he and Sarah go on to have a child named Isaac, and ultimately their descendants are as numerous as the stars and include Jesus himself. To be fair, it is not a covenant that is full only of sunshine and rainbows. In fact, in the verses of Genesis 15 that the lectionary text conveniently leaves out, God promises that Abram's offspring will be slaves in a foreign land for 400 years, probably not the certainty that Abram was looking for. Abram will never see the fulfillment of God's covenant. It's a good 15 years before he even gets the first glimpse of the work that God will do with the birth of Isaac. And I have to admit, it's true for us too. We might not see the fulfillment of those things we are longing for. I'm not here to preach some false prosperity gospel today and say that everything you're hoping for will happen, because it's not the case. Jesus himself said that in this life we will have trouble. And part of the good news of today's text is that we can be honest in the lament of those things. And the good news that I must cling to, the river in this desert, is that God keeps his promises. I have to remember that the heat of the desert will not dry up the river. I have to remember that the stars are so numerous in the sky, I can't even count them, even on the days when the Chicago smog makes it seem like there are none. I choose, like Abram chose, to believe in the midst of my lament that God continues working, even when I can't see it. And so perhaps this Lent, our best spiritual practice is to get in the habit of looking for the rivers in the desert. And so I leave you today with one very small story of how I've seen this in my own life just over the past couple of weeks. Before the pandemic shut down Chicago, I used to go to the Art Institute just about every week, where my favorite piece was this 1879 pastel by Edgar Degas called The Star. I have loved Degas and his ballet dancers since my elementary school art unit. One of many paintings of dancers, The Star depicts prima ballerina Rosita Mari, casually posed in third position. I love the strength and dignity with which Degas depicted this dancer, and I rarely went to the Art Institute without at least going by and waving hello. In the grand scheme of the pandemic, the loss of my weekly trips to the Art Institute was a very, very small thing, but I mourned it nonetheless. And on my first trip back after almost a year away, I found myself rushing to the wings where I knew where my friend was kept. I rounded her corner, my throat caught with excitement, only to find out she was gone, along with many other works by Degas, and I stood there strangely bereft. I had built up this moment so much in my head. In my imagination, it was going to be a river of normality in the desert of the pandemic. And I stood in the corner that day feeling lost and disappointed and grieved. I found myself wondering if that moment was going to be a symbolic of all of our reopenings, if when I returned to church or school or work, I would only discover that when I turned a corner, somehow over the course of the pandemic, a beloved friend had gone and I did not get to say goodbye. I had returned that day looking for a river, but instead I found more desert. And the story might have ended there, with longing for beauty that I cannot access. But this January, I started taking ballet classes. I've never taken a dance class before in my life. I am very much not good. I don't think it's something I ever could have articulated as a child as saying, like, yes, I want to do this. Though growing up in a single-parent home with very limited income, I learned early on to keep my dreams small. But this fall, the longing to take ballet started to worm its way into my heart, and my family bought me lessons for Christmas. And so for the last 7 weeks, I have pried myself way too early out of bed on Saturday mornings so that I can be in the South Loop for a 9 a.m. class. And taking off my shoes after that first lesson, I noticed tears start to pool in my eyes. I suddenly remembered being 6 years old, folding my feet into first position after getting a ballet Barbie, thinking about dancing but knowing it wasn't really in my cards. I remembered my decades-long fascination with Degas and his dancers and how I used to just stand in front of the star and marvel. And now here I was too, shoes on my feet, hair up in a bun, arms on the bar. Is taking a ballet class the deepest longing of my heart? No, not by far. I wouldn't consider it as important as some of the things I've been praying for years. I certainly wasn't longing for it as deeply as I long for the injustices of the world to be made right. And still, I found comfort this week in acknowledging that decades in the making, this longing too could be fulfilled. And I found comfort and hope in the fact that if it worked out that this small, insignificant longing could be fulfilled, certainly then God could keep his promise for the big things, the one that really mattered, even if I never see it. This is the tension that I want to sit in today, and that I invite you to sit in with me. I want to be honest about my deserts. I want to bring to God the full extent of my lament and longing. And two, I want to acknowledge the tiny streams of relief that lead to the river of grace and belief. I want to keep my eyes on the ways that God has been fulfilling longings and keeping promises, even if it's something as small as a Saturday morning ballet class. I want to lean into the words of Psalm 27, in which David proclaims that he remains confident of this: I will see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. And there is life in the desert. I want eyes that seek out the grace of rivers, even in the barren places. Because if there is one thing that growing up in Wenatchee taught me, it's that the bank of the river in the middle of the desert is not a bad place to call home. Thanks be to God.